I'm up on the tight wire.
I'm sitting here in Studio B, sitting across from my good friend, Daniel Chacon.
And I'm sitting across from my good friend, Benjamin Alida Sainz.
And welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire.
We have another great show for you today. We have the poet Megan Bohegan, whose new book of poems, Sightlines, has just been released. It's a beautiful book of poems. Plus, she's from Fresno, my hometown.
And she'll be also reading the poem of the week.
And on Poetic License, we have I like to call her our own because she had got her MFA here and she's from El Paso, although now she lives in Livermore, California, where I used to live, by the way. J.L. Powers, and we're looking forward to seeing what she has to say.
Yes, I'm sure her reflections will be profound.
Absolutely. She's a very profound woman. I have a deep respect for her.
As do I.
Yes, and as she does to you. And I don't know if she has respect for me, but she knows me and she waves at me when I see her at conferences.
And I'm wondering if she likes broccoli.
I don't know. We're going to have to ask her that question.
Do you like broccoli?
Why do you ask?
Yesterday, when you were making dinner, Daniel right now is we're roomies for this month, which is really a very exciting.
Oh, yeah.
An interesting
Absolutely.
Experience.
Every day is dynamic with Ben.
And Daniel was making broccoli.
Well, then you know the answer. Yes, I must like it.
I hate broccoli.
Yeah, I know. You expressed
that. And
I hate
the smell of broccoli.
Yes, yes. I know you expressed that. But, you know, I like broccoli. I think it's nice, especially if you don't overcook it. I think that's the key. When I grew up, you know, I grew up in a very working class family. We never had vegetables unless they were completely overcooked and smothered in cheese sauce. But I like a nice crunchy broccoli. And the other day, I actually went to a bar. I very rarely go to bars, but this time I thought I would. And I sat
and
at the bar.
And they had broccoli there?
And I ordered a wine. And I looked at the menu and they had burgers and they had fish tacos. And I'm thinking, what am I going to get? And you know what I felt like? I felt like a plate of steamed broccoli. So I said to the bartender, can I get a plate of steamed broccoli? And he had to think about it for a while. And he goes, let me go ask. So he ran to the kitchen and goes, yeah, sure. And I says, make sure it's lightly steamed because I like it crunchy. So I sat there at the bar drinking wine and eating crunchy broccoli.
That's disgusting.
That's a little weird for a bar, but hey, I know what I like. And I like the poetry of Megan Bohegan, whose new book, Sightlines, just came out. So stick around and we will talk to her about all things poetry.
Stay tuned for another edition of Words on a Wire.
Megan Bohegan was born in New York City and grew up in San Francisco. She came of age and lives today in the agricultural heartland of Fresno, California, my hometown, which has grown, among other things, a rich crop of writers. She is a graduate student of the California Institute of the Arts and holds a Master's of Fine Arts degree in creative writing from California State University, Fresno. She has taught creative writing and English at all levels, teaches workshops in poetry and memoir, and participates actively in the poetry community. Her work has been published in numerous print and electronic journals. Sightlines is her first book. Megan Bohegan, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure.
And your book just came out, Sightlines, but there's no poem entitled Sightlines. So to me, that kind of means that somehow Sightlines captures the spirit, the sentido, the essence of the entire book. Can you tell us what sightlines means to you?
Well, sightlines is an old theater term that has to do with what you can see from any given place, say in the audience of a theater, and what you can't see. And it deliberately, everything is staged within the sightlines, mm-hmm. so everyone can see. But in real life, we have the sight lines that we think we see, and we have sight lines that prevent us from seeing. And I think that's what intrigued me about the title, that these are poems that come from, in many cases, these are poems about things that happened a long time ago.
Mm.
So they're seen again in the way that we revision our work, our life, through eyes that are in a different point of perspective, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You know, in fact, reading your book, one of the things that I noticed is that the poems can be so focused on something that's just right in front of you, like the backyard and the, you know, and the flowers and, you know, and all these things that are just right there. But you get this sense, and it's a really nice sense, that it's about not just what's in front of you, but what is kind of just slightly outside of the picture.
Yes. Yes. And the title poem very much is that kind of poem, because it really is about what's on the other side of the wall.
Right. Oh, yeah, that's true, huh?
The beauty of the whatever is protected or insulated.
Right.
Yeah.
Megan, do you trust memory, or does that matter?
That's an excellent question. It depends. That's a terrible answer for a wonderful question. Memory is complicated because it goes through many filters. And I trust the feelings that were engendered at the time of a memory, probably more than the details of the memory that I think I remember.
Yeah, I totally agree.
So in a sense, it doesn't matter, because what, as a writer, I need to do is to create in a concrete image the something that feels true, that feels it belongs with the emotion.
I think Antonin Artaud said, we have the right to lie, but not about the heart of the matter.
I think that's true. It's also been said that, I'm going to mess this up badly, it's a great quote, though, but it has to do with being faithful, having permission to alter the facts
mm-hmm.
in the service of the truth.
Right, right.
Yeah. I think there's a kind of like a, I can use this as an example, that's like, that we are not so much the products of history, we're the products of our understanding of history, in the same way that we are not so much the products of our memory, but we're the products of our understanding of our memory.
Well, that's true. And also, if we're remembering something from, say, childhood, there's a whole lot that was going on that we don't even know about, right? We're only given our own little perspective to operate from. And so part of the interesting challenge of writing is not just one's own perspective, but other perspectives as well.
We're talking to Megan Bohegian, author of the new book of poems called Sightlines. And Megan, we're talking to you from El Paso, Texas, and you are in Fresno, California, which is my other home. Fresno has, as we were walking over here to the studio, Ben was talking about, he was asking me questions about Fresno, what's it like, and trying to get me to describe it to him. And I did my best. But one of the things that he commented on is, he goes, it's like El Paso. There are so many writers that come out of Fresno. And it's true. There are so many writers. What is it about Fresno that, in your opinion, that is producing so many writers? And what does Fresno mean to you as a poet?
Well, those are excellent questions as well. My novelist friend, Steve Yarborough, I brought Steve to my classroom once to talk to students about Southern writing, particularly. And what he said about Fresno is he felt that Fresno, because it is such a multicultural place and it is not a refined place,
mm-hmm.
there is such friction in a good way, the kind of friction that produces the pearl in an oyster.
Oh, that is a really good insight.
That there's friction in between all of these different people, and that one of the products of that type of friction is writing. One of the ways people express their responses to friction is writing, even if that's not their subject, even if that friction is not the subject of their writing.
The thing about Fresno, if you want to go get Indian food, for example, you don't go to a restaurant that says authentic Indian food. You go to an Indian strip mall where everything is Indian, including the stores.
Exactly.
And you eat at a restaurant there, which just serves all Indians. Yeah. It's very, very diverse and very, very, there's a lot of racial and political tension there.
There is, and there's a lot of many things of those types that need to be opened up and changed. When I moved to Fresno as a young teenager from San Francisco, where I grew up, and where I lived in San Francisco was very integrated. And so I grew up with a school vice principal who was African-American and kids in my class, you know, of all races, and that seemed normal to me. And when I moved to Fresno, at that time, Fresno was very segregated. And I'd never seen anything like it, and I'd also never heard racist language before. I moved to Fresno. So I got into big arguments very quickly once I moved to Fresno, because it struck me as just bizarre.
So how has that affected your poetry?
Well, I think it's always put me, my life has put me on the side of the underdog, in a sense. I identify far more with, for example, the community where I taught, which was, well, let's just put it this way, the school where I taught, there were only 4% Caucasian children.
Mm-hmm.
So it was every other possible language and lots of second language students, and I identified very strongly with them. I also appreciate them as a teacher of writing. I appreciate the way they approach language with a kind of an excitement and a discovery, which I would hope I always have as a writer. The power of language to convey what it is you really mean means something to someone who is acquiring that language.
I have your book in my hand right now, and on page the first poem, which you referred to earlier, it's called "Feeling Safe in the Neighborhood," and I love this poem because it essentially details and describes, you know, the backyard and the garden and the flowers, and it says heavy blooms fragrant as grapes and iris waiting to burst yellow or blue, but at the same time there's this wall and there's this ghetto bird, this helicopter flying around as it will do in Fresno. And so there's still even though it's like there's safety, there's also this just incredible tension that the city seems to be pushing almost on the walls.
I think there is that, and I think I've noticed in my prose writing, the whole idea of the focal length we choose, what is the length of the lens through which we're viewing whatever we see, makes a huge difference in how we see things. We can focus in so tight, like on a flower that's just blooming,
mm-hmm.
that we don't see what's going on just right on the other side of the wall. And I think that's very important to remember, because writers are observant in ways other people may not be, and if we're only looking through a very small lens, we're not doing our writing a very great service.
Megan, you seem to be a very politically aware person, so why write poetry?
Well, that's a very good question. I think poetry has the capacity to affect people beyond just their intellect, so that arguments that are posed in a newspaper editorial or a political speech, for example, are so easily rebutted. Before the words are even out, the opponent or a person who disagrees already has their ammunition. They're already firing the guns. They're not even letting the ideas in. But poetry works on people on many levels. And it casts a kind of spell with the music of language and with the power of imagery, with the immediacy when an image is so concrete you can see it in your own mind. There is now a space in which an idea as well can become embedded. So I think poetry is enormously powerful as a tool for communicating ideas as well as experience or more lyrical function.
When did you start writing poetry?
I began writing poetry when I was quite young, but I wrote it fairly seriously through college. I went to the California Institute of the Arts, and we were lucky to be able to study where we wanted, pretty much. And there were some visiting poets there whom I was able to work with. So I enjoyed that a lot. But I then got sidetracked by life, the way you do.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a journalist and later a teacher. So I began to work when I went into seriously on poetry in about 2003, when I went into the MFA program. And I had written a lot before that, but not with a very self-critical eye. Mm. And I certainly hadn't done the reading, the breadth of reading of poetry that I have learned to do.
I'm looking at your poem, Hungry Ghosts, and it says, "For my student whose uncle murdered his own wife, six children, and himself." You're a teacher. What do you teach, and how does your teaching affect your poetry, and how have your students influenced you? I'm going to ask you a little bit about your teachers later on, because we have some of the same teachers, but how have your students influenced, how has teaching influenced your poetry?
Well, whatever else my job title was, I've always been a creative writing teacher, and so I've had groups of students. Some of that's been done in the classroom, and a lot of it's been done extracurricularly. And the time that I've spent with those students has been enormously powerful. I actually have a lot of poems about students. They just didn't make their way into this particular collection. The lives that my students lead, and I should say my school where I taught was a school of high poverty, high transience, people who've had a very difficult time. Many of my students had very, very young parents, and many of them had and have parents or relatives, close relatives to them who are in prison. They've had very unstable lives by, the assumptions that people make about what children's lives are like. These are children who may have attended 14 schools before they got to high school. You know, they've been everywhere. And so listening to their stories and watching what happens as they use language to unearth their own lives, and also enormously courageous. And I really think some of our wonderful next generation writers are going to come out of these kids. And one of them, Kathy Zhang, is already widely published. So she was my student who had an interesting life. And it is definitely fuel for her writing. That particular poem, Hungry Ghosts, was a student of mine who was blocked as a writer because every time she tried to write anything, the story of what had happened, what her uncle had done, intruded into her writing. And she felt he was always there as a shadow. And whatever she wanted to write, even if it was a version of a Hmong folk tale or an essay, this problem that this terrible act of self-destruction and family destruction.
Well, there are definitely ghosts in our language, that's for
yeah.
sure. You know, my first book, Chicano Chicanery, the story that was most successful is called Godoy Lives, and it's about this guy who has a fake green card that, you know, someone sends him from a dead guy. And I remember I used to teach at the community college when I first got out of grad school at the University of Oregon, because you can't get a job at a university without a book. And I taught pre-comp, and one of my students wrote that story basically about her father, how he got to the other side by using this fake green card and how nervous he was. And so I stole the story completely from her. And when the book came out, I did a reading at MJC, and she was there. And she comes up to me afterwards. She goes, "Oh, that sounds so familiar."
Wow.
But, you know, I mean, obviously I didn't steal the language or steal the character or anything, but just the idea of that fake green card. And, yeah, it's just there's so many rich, rich stories in the Valley, and I suppose everywhere. I read poetry for the lines. I mean, I'm mostly a fiction writer, and now I'm writing little TV, but I do it for the lines. And I found a line in your poem that I think is really beautiful, and I don't know why, but for some reason it resonates with my artistic sensibility, and I wanted to read it to you. Are you ready?
Sure.
My favorite line in your whole book. It's going to sound crazy to you. Doors in a bakery are never slammed. I love that line. I don't know why. What does that line mean to you? You know what poem it's from, obviously.
Doors in a bakery. Well, a bakery is where we have things growing and rising and coming up, and the slamming of a door jars whatever's rising and it falls. So that's a poem that contrasts the phenomenon of the bakery with a relationship in which there's a lot of slamming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love the title. Can you tell us the title of that poem?
It's called, in French, Bread is Spelled Pain.
Nice. We've been talking to Megan Bohigian on Words on a Wire. And Megan, and now we're going to ask you to read a poem, to select a poem so that you can read our poem of the week.
This, it's a poem called Learning to Dive, Chapman Compound Pool, 1962. I was 10 in Cuernavaca, and while my family fought for life beyond my father's death, I compelled myself to dive. As white sun glazed the deck and shadows shrank, I'd climb the diving wall and stand as if I had no plan to plunge headfirst into a deep blue future that lapped a rim I wasn't sure I'd reach on one held breath. Riveted, I couldn't turn away, but wouldn't leave the world. Not the wall's slick surface, the tickling grass, my brother floating in the shallows on his back, the cabana's purple shade. Could not commit to vanish into unending blue, stretch through, slice water that sealed up behind me like the kitchen door against El Tito's backside every morning. For days, I watched this torpedo of a pig who once had been a pet descend. He minced past us with stiletto steps through gates, layered gardens, and lemon groves to disappear in the barranca's tangled green. On the morning of his execution, as El Tito shrieked and squealed, I raised my arms, held my breath, closed my eyes, and dove.
That was lovely. Thank you for being on Words on a Wire, Megan.
Thank you.
My name is J.L. Powers, although many people in El Paso know me as Jessica. I'm the author of three novels for young adults, The Confessional, This Thing Called the Future, and Amina, and also the editor of two collections of essays, one called Labor Pains and Birth Stories, and one called That Mad Game Growing Up in a War Zone. I grew up in El Paso, and although I live in California now, I still consider El Paso home. Today I want to talk about fear, the kind of earth-shattering, mind-blowing fear that can change the entire trajectory of your life. It certainly changed my life and is probably why I became a writer. Some of my earliest memories include the fear of being murdered. I dreaded looking into mirrors, afraid I would see a beefy, red-faced man behind me, his hands outstretched, ready to grab my throat and throttle me. Night after night, I lay awake after my parents and brothers had gone to sleep. Every creak in the house sounded like an intruder creeping down the hallway, coming into my bedroom, and standing over my bed to stare at me. I covered my face with blankets and breathed shallowly. Maybe, I imagined, the intruder would think the lump was just a pile of blankets and not a little girl. The air under the blanket grew hot and suffocating, but I stayed in the stale, steamy darkness, listening. Instead of outgrowing these childhood fears, they grew worse as I grew older. When I was about 9 years old, several incidents convinced me that Satan wasn't just an imaginary menace, but that he wanted to possess me, body, mind, and soul. So the time of terror began. I had entered a world of monsters, invisible but real. For at least a couple of years, the fear was paralyzing. In the morning, life was all right. But just after lunch, dread clamped its vicious hand around my stomach in anticipation of the coming darkness of night. In bed at night, I barely clung to sanity, listening to music and reciting a repetitive mantra prayer for hours until I fell asleep. Fear baptized me into adulthood and, I should add, the liberating world of books. Because it turned out to be simple, ordinary things that helped me to get a grip on my extraordinary fear. An incident in South Africa a few years ago reminded me of this. South Africa is a country possessed by fear. The fear is inspired by very real, very brutal murders, violent muggings, carjackings, and rapes. Many people live in fortresses, During my second visit to the country, I stayed with a young woman around my age who had recently broken up with her fiancé and was now living in an enormous and largely empty house. She had all the bells and whistles of security, the electronic gate, the high walls, the electric wires with voltage high enough to kill the monkey that accidentally grabbed onto the wire and then couldn't let go. At the time, South Africa was also having problems with blackouts, and stories circulated that criminals waited until the electricity had been turned off, and then they went in and robbed houses, often killing the homeowners. Every night, alone in this big, empty house, I was terrified. Ironically, all that security made me feel less secure. I holed up in my bedroom, sleeping with the lights on and music playing. I tried not to think about the statistics or the countrywide electricity failures. But here's the funny thing. Whenever the cat came into the bedroom and rubbed up against my legs, purring contentedly, I felt instantly better. It's completely irrational, I know. But somehow it felt as though the cat would know if somebody was trying to break in, and he wouldn't be purring or rubbing my legs. So if he wasn't scared, I didn't need to be either. And this reminded me that back when I was a child, I devised simple but ingenious ways to deal with the terror I felt. As a very young child waiting for that kidnapper or murderer who was coming down the hallway to find me, the fear disappeared immediately if the heater came on or the refrigerator started running. The everyday sounds of my house, like the cat purring in South Africa, took my fear away. And as for Satan, over time, I learned to wait until my parents were asleep. And then I read novels until 2 or 3 in the morning, losing myself in the stories of other people's lives, in their joys and sorrows and fears, until I was so exhausted, I simply had to sleep. I don't know how many people in this world are gripped by paralyzing fears. I know I'm not alone. Yet I also know that what people fear differs from person to person, and therefore the way they experience and get over fear must also be different. Yet I suspect that other people have experienced the way that simple, ordinary, everyday things can jolt you out of fear. How a cat's purr reminds you that you're not alone. How the ordinary workings of the house remind you of the inexorable workings of the universe, and how everything is so much bigger than yourself. Or how immersing yourself in other people's lives through the art of story reminds you that all of life isn't about you, and you aren't the focus or target, and so perhaps, in the end, you have less to fear than you think. This is J.L. Powers for Words on a Wire.
Thank you for listening to another edition of Words on a Wire.
And thank you, Megan Bohegian, and Ben and I will be in Fresno touring the city, and we are going to stay in your guest bedroom, so please prepare it for us.
J.L. Powers, thank you for your thoughtful reflections.
And thank you, Ben, for being such a great co-host. Thank you, Norma Martinez, our producer. And if you want to listen to our past shows, go to ktep.org and find us under Words on a Wire. I'm Daniel Chacon.
I'm Benjamin Alita Sines.
And don't forget, the next book you read
may save your life.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on a tight rope. One side's hate and one is hope.